Hi, this is Bhava Kulkarni, and welcome to a very late episode of Cognitive Snap. It's been a wild few months, both globally and for me personally, and it really feels like a period of transition. I don't know where we're all headed, but I know we're not there yet. And so, in the midst of all this, in this episode, I bring you something a little more lighthearted, a little more joyous, a symbol of celebration. Cake.
You're very precisely adding a certain amount of different ingredients together and then letting them very controlledly explode in a hot environment for a certain amount of time. I mean, basically, that's what you're doing when you're baking.
My guest today is Orlando Lovell. And I have to be honest, I'm having some trouble describing her. So I'm just going to let you find out more about her gradually, just as I did through the conversations I had with her. I came across her while I was Googling her mother, Sophie Lovell, who's an acclaimed design journalist. But then I landed up on Orlando's website. Orlando studied design and architecture at Central St. Martin's in London, and then at the Design Academy in Eindhoven. And since then, she's curated installations, taught workshops, been art director for publications, and currently she is the communications manager at the Dutch Institute of Food and Design. While all that is really impressive, the very first sentence on her about page caught my eye and I emailed her pretty much as soon as I finished reading that sentence. And this was the sentence. She says that she's an interdisciplinary designer whose main medium is cake. When we eventually got in touch and started talking, I guess I started with the most obvious question.
How did you get into baking?
Yeah, that's a really common question. And I always kind of, it feels strange because the word baking doesn't feel right. But I guess we'll get to that. I got into baking when I was 15, 16. And it was purely by accident. So it was no fascination of my own, really. I was just working in a catering service in Berlin for the summer, as you do when you're that age and just want to earn a bit of money. And I worked for a American-Italian lady. And she can't bake at all. So she was like, hey, you, new girl, can you bake? And I was like, yeah, sure. I think anybody can bake, right? So that was really my assumption. I grew up in a kind of with my mom being able to bake very well, my grandfather being an excellent baker. And I'd never thought about it. So I was just like, this is normal. This is fine. It's just going to work out. And that's what I went home with. And I think you need that confidence in baking because it kind of lives off that emotion or that confidence. If you're sad, if you're stressed, if you're distracted, it's not going to work. Mm. So I'm really glad I kind of approached it with that kind of gung-ho attitude. And I was like, okay, somebody ordered a huge cake, two tiers. It was like 30 centimeters high, covered in frosting and little baubles and raspberries and whatnot. And they wanted the phrase perception is reality written on top. Now, I had never held a piping bag in my life, ever. So I loved the fact that they just kind of trusted me with this entirely. And it worked out fine. So, yeah.
So what did she say when you delivered the cake? Was she surprised?
She was over the moon. She was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I mean, in true American exuberance, she was very, very happy with it all. And we went on to work together for quite a long time. Like, I think I was here for 3 more years in Berlin before I moved to London to study. And she was doing a lot of wedding catering and photoshoot catering. And I would just bake whenever I have time between school and whatever. Mm.
And somewhere around that time, she founded her own baking company called Cakes Are Not Evil. She then went out to study design and architecture in London, all the while doing internships with chefs and food photographers, all the while staying true to her medium of cake.
So I thought that you were interested in design,
mm-hmm.
and you were also interested in baking,
mm-hmm.
and then you sort of...
merged them.
Yeah. That isn't exactly how it worked, right?
Yeah, I mean, if I think back to it, it was just a series of coincidences, which I really love. Like, that's a lot of my work is also based on this. I love the word and the whole concept of serendipity. And I think that's really followed me throughout my whole career so far. So just doing these cakes and kind of making them on the side, I realized that they would also be great to capture because it's such a fleeting product. You make it, you let it go out of your house, someone consumes it, it's gone. And you say, oh, you can't tell a person about the cake you made, or you can, but if you take a picture of it, it kind of communicates even better. So I think around the same age where I made my first cake, my dad gave me a nice camera for Christmas one year. And so I would just start taking pictures of the cakes that I made. And I kind of, I don't know, how many years ago is that? 10 years? We were making blogs at the time. It was okay. So I had a little cake blog and posted these pictures, and it became a kind of communication tool. And then a few years later, when I was applying to university for design-related kind of topics, be that graphic design, product, or architecture, I was really open to all of them. This was the main visual material I had. Like, I had all these pictures of these cakes, and I had all this experience in producing. And I really realized that if I could communicate that, then it wouldn't be kind of a waste of my time in a different field, but much more a smart translation of using an uncommon medium in the same field. So I applied with a portfolio full of cake to product design in Berlin at two universities, London at Central St. Martin's, and in Eindhoven in the Netherlands. And all of them opened me with welcomed me with open arms. Because I had tried, or maybe successfully communicated, that I'd been doing graphic design with the visual kind of components of the cake, using frosting and different decorational elements. And that was kind of the visual design part. Using product design in a very kind of business related way, in the way that I would communicate with clients, have these emails, talk about pricing, talk about quantity, talk about like how many people, how many pieces, do those kind of calculations, talk about size and construct. And then that step further also in terms of architecture, in terms of stability and form and those things that go beyond but are still edible. So that was for me a real kind of smart step to get into, to be able to have those conversations with creatives and also feel like I was allowed to be there, even though I hadn't done any kind of other designing prior. Like, I just managed to twist my medium or to fit. Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, that's actually fascinating, because when I discovered design in the seventh semester of my mechanical engineering.
Everyone discovers design at some point.
Right? Yeah. Good. Okay. And I thought that I would be a product designer, an industrial designer. You're saying that you already had your medium in mind. So I didn't. And so when I got into my master's program into industrial design, I think I was a little lost, but it feels like you were not.
I'm very good at maybe not seeming lost, but I think I was also lost because I didn't necessarily identify with cake as my medium. Maybe not as I do now. Even now, I guess I kind of try and contradict it sometimes, because cake also brings with it a lot of female qualities, a lot of kind of very feminine aspects and narratives, and a lot of kind of, in German we have this wonderful word, brav, which is sweet, kind, innocent to a certain degree. Growing up in Berlin in the 90s, I wouldn't really want to identify with the word of innocent. So I always kind of tried to distance myself from the medium as well. And I didn't really welcome it with open arms. It was more that I wanted to use cake because it would communicate my way of thinking. So for me, I didn't want to be a product designer. I wanted to be a design thinker. I very clearly found out quite quickly that I wanted to learn design thinking and then go back out and apply that in some way to anything else. I didn't really care. I didn't want to be someone who produces or is part of that very strict system. Much more I wanted to take from it or understand it and see things in a different way. And cake was the smart way of showing that I could think this way. So I could be like, hey, look at this thing you all know. This is how I think about it. And that really worked. So that really kind of showed people, oh, she twists things. It's fun. It's interesting. She approaches things in the right way for her to be part of our teaching. But then once I was in university and school, I really didn't work with it anymore. I kind of closed those doors and because it was a way to make money when I was young. It was just a source of income for me and then a source of communication. Once those two uses weren't necessary anymore, I thought like, okay, we're good. Now I'm off to learn about metal and wood and whatever else you do in product design or generally design. So
right. But you didn't like those media, right?
No.
That's what you said.
Yeah. So I think not so much at Central St. Martin's, but especially later in Eindhoven, we had a full year where we had to explore all mediums. Well, most or many mediums. We had to work with wood. We had to work with plastic. We had to work with foam and, you know, whatever else you do. Oh, and I hated it. I hated every second of it. It was so wasteful. And there was so much left over. And I'd always try and just like buy as little as possible or use as little as possible. Because I always felt like, what am I going to do with the leftovers? And I don't want this. And I'd save every little scrap. Like for ages, I'd have all the little pieces of plastic that I'd cut off of something. I was like, what am I going to do with this? I have to do something with this. And I actually also got criticized quite a lot for kind of recycling a lot or using a lot of kind of secondhand materials. And my teachers were like, be original, do something new. And I'm like, but there's all this leftover. What am I going to do with that? And coming from baking, like being that being the only medium I kind of knew before, it seemed so different because in baking, you use everything. And whatever is left over, you give to someone, they eat it, and it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever is left over from baking is eggshells. And they go in the compost and you're good. That didn't work in uni. That freaked me out.
Now, I'm not particularly into cakes or baking or cooking in general. I enjoy cooking sometimes, sure, but I don't really think about it too much. So when I emailed her, I knew Orlando would be interesting to talk to, but I didn't expect myself to actually care about baking itself. But when she talks about it, she makes it sound like so much fun. Like, listen to this from our first Zoom call.
Nice. What was the most unusual event you've made a cake for?
Hands down, Switzerland. So I made a series of cakes for Herzog & Dömeron, the architects, the Basel-based architects. They were celebrating an anniversary of a building that they'd constructed, and they were celebrating in the special room of the Kunsthalle in Basel, so this kind of art exhibition space. And they had a special room where they just installed a lamp by Werner Panton, which was this kind of sea of shell-like construction. So it looked like pyramids, but upside down on the ceiling, made of lots of shell pieces. It was fantastically beautiful, very atmospheric room. And I was pitched this from kind of different sides, from the architects and also the head of the architecture museum at the time in Basel. And it turned into, I think it was about 70... men and women in their fancy dress suits and dresses and everything. No one had had dinner, and I served a series of 5 different cakes in this hall with champagne. And it was an energy that I've never experienced before. There was excitement and laughter and people passing the cakes across the tables to each other.
with the knives like flying around and everybody getting progressively more drunk and excited from the sugar shock. It was really exciting. And that kind of fueled a lot of my project afterwards. This was like, I don't know, 3-4 years ago, I think, to search for that energy and that connection and that somewhat even childish excitement in people who have very serious lives. That's really the magic of cake for me, which I love and I'm always kind of searching for.
This is the fun part about her cake stories. It's never about the cake itself. She's told me about 5 or 6 different cakes she's baked now, some of her friends and co-workers, some of her clients, some of her projects with other artists. But when she talks about the cakes, it's never about what she puts in it or how she baked it or even what it looked like. This is why I understand her hesitation in calling herself a baker or a cake designer. I get this nervousness, you know, to give yourself a label that you don't really relate to fully. And I think most designers today have this problem. Gone are the days when you could neatly define yourself with 1 or 2 words.
How do you, let's say that you meet someone for the first time and they don't know that you're into cake.
Mm.
Do you bring it up? Do you try to figure
out
what that
is? The way you're saying that. They don't know yet, but how do you bring it up? This is a wonderful question. I'm trying to think of those scenarios. To be honest, I think it's always someone else that brings it up. I don't really talk about it. But that's also the interesting thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I say, oh, I bake cake, I get put into a drawer that doesn't reflect what I do. So I don't even want to start that conversation. So I kind of wait until other people, if it's important, then of course I say something, but mostly someone else might reference it. And I remember very distinctly one moment in Switzerland when I was living in Basel. I went to kind of a lecture, can't remember what it was about. And I went with my boss at the time, Matilda. And we were, after the lecture, I think we were standing outside with a group of 4 or 5 people. And we were talking to a guy I'd never met and going back and forth. And Matilda said, Orlando bakes. And I was like, didn't say anything else. And the guy kind of looked at me and said, oh, that's so fascinating. I have a story about cake. And I was like, okay. He went on to tell this beautiful and surreal story about when he grew up and was very young, his parents split up and he stayed with his mother, but he was still going to a kind of primary school, so I guess he must have been like 5 or 6 or so. And he went into school in the following days and didn't really talk about it, but just told his classmates that he was now a baker and he was baking at night and making money and taking care of his mother and financially and everything. And he was building this whole world where he was becoming this super professional baker and being very successful. And this whole narrative that he'd built for himself as a kid of this second life was in order to protect his mother and kind of be there and take care of her. And that kind of, I guess you could say, an alter ego or something. You're like, by night, I'm this amazing, fantastic baker, and I earned all this money, and by day, I'm here at school learning with you guys. And again...
A superpower.
Yes. But again, in this moment, it was such deeply personal thing. Like, if you'd taken the cake out of that equation and that connection to share that story, it would be just someone that... I can't remember his name, a stranger I've never met again... telling me about how it was growing up when his parents split up. And that's a very different conversation. That nearly never would happen, I think. So I think also the less you put into people's mouths or the less space you take, people will give or fill that kind of whatever connotation they have with the medium you work with. So if I relate it to what I'm kind of trying to convey or what I'm looking at in my work, using something that is very commonly known as the medium of cake, you don't need to give it much. You just need to be able to twist it slightly and then leave the person to process their own experiences and knowledge against what you're trying to twist for them. So I tend to not bring up cake from my point of view. Much rather, I let people introduce me to their world of cake.
Did you hear Orlando mention the medium of cake just now? That's what got me thinking about media. In the 1800s, the German philosopher Ernst Kapp claimed that the tools we use are extensions of our bodies. You know, the hammer is an extension of the arm, the wheel is an extension of the foot, and so on. And in the mid-1900s, there was a man saying the same thing about media and communication technologies. Except he was saying that the media are extensions of our senses. And his name was Marshall McLuhan.
My kind of study in communication is really a study of transformation, whereas information theory and all the existing theories of communication that I know of are theories of transportation. All the official theories of communication studied in the schools of North America are theories of how you move data from point A to point B to point C with minimal distortion. That is not what I study at all. My theory or concern is with what do these media do to the people who use them? What did writing do to the people who invented it and used it? What do the other media of our time do to the people who use it? So mine is a transformation theory, how people are changed by the instruments they employ.
And design has elements of both transportation and transformation. Of course, we want to communicate as clearly and efficiently as possible, which is the transportation part, but we also care about how we affect, how we transform the receiver of the communication, the user. This is, after all, why it's called user experience design. This is why designers care deeply about how people are changed by the products they employ. Not just what the product is, or if they use it properly. And that's why Orlando cares so much about the effect cake has on people. Here she is again.
I'm also going to tell you another quote here, because this is something that is really, this is the key quote that has followed me throughout everything I do, and has, I think, also been kind of the motivation for a lot of my work. And it's from Emily Bentley. She's a professor of food studies in the Department of Nutrition and Food at NYU, New York. And she says, in her book Eating for Victory from 1998, she says, "No matter how serious the issue we are addressing, such as sexual harassment or racial and gender stereotypes, if I serve some of my banana or pumpkin bread at the meeting, people seem to interact better and tend to be more relaxed. It helps to stimulate a dialogue and bring out the best in people. Maybe because they connected with images of the family and home." So that for me is really key, using cake, being smart about it. It's a tool, it's a superpower. It's something that can connect, can relax, can bring people around a table and can really let them open up to topics they feel very uncomfortable with, maybe. And in that sense, I'm really not the focal point here. Again, in terms of design, I step out of the room. The cake should also not be the topic of conversation. It shouldn't be so wowing that nothing else happens but talk of the cake.
And the sound of munching.
I don't care about that. Like, I don't want to hear what it looks like or how it tastes. Tell me your connection to it. Tell me your experience. Let's have a conversation. Let's have a real conversation.
After the interview, I remember Orlando telling me how she gets annoyed during some interviews because they would ask her what her favorite flavor of cake is. And listening back to her now, it's understandable, right? The flavor of the cake is really not important. Even in that quote by Emily Bentley, the cake doesn't need to be banana bread. The fact that there is cake, the conventions and connotations we have associated to cake in general, is much more important than what kind of cake it is. And guess who said this beautifully almost 60 years ago? Marshall McLuhan. In fact, this is probably his most famous sentence. He said, "The medium is the message." He even wrote a book in collaboration with the graphic designer Quentin Fiori called The Medium is the Message. Actually, it was called The Medium is the Massage, but that's a different story. What he means to say, though, is that sentence, "The medium is the message." Here he is again.
Yes. You see, it doesn't much matter what you say on the telephone. The telephone as a service is a huge environment, and that is the medium. And the environment affects everybody. What you say on the telephone affects very few. And the same with radio or any other medium. What you print is nothing compared to the effect of the printed word. The printed word sets up a paradigm, a structure of awareness, which affects everybody in very, very drastic ways. And it doesn't very much matter what you print as long as you go on with that form of activity.
If the medium is the message, then it becomes increasingly clear that communicators and designers should really get to know their medium if they are to use it properly. As her graduation project at Eindhoven, Orlando actually wrote a book on the social and cultural significance of cake.
A book isn't really a book, it's just a collection of little thoughts that I found along the way.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really exist in much of a format. It's black and white. It's one single copy in the world right now. Mm. And it's kind of A5 and very small. And it just says cake on the front.
Cake full stop.
Yeah, cake full stop. It's not much really. It's maybe just a designed notepad of mine. I remember I created it in Switzerland West. I was there for an exchange for half a year. And I realized kind of that point had come between collecting people's anecdotes and me using cake as my own kind of communication medium, maybe in terms of design, and wanting to educate myself. And I was like, okay, I've reached this point where I can't continue basing my work on cake and not know more about it. Not know more about it as a historic medium, as whatever facets it has in politics or feminism, maybe even, or whatever else we want to talk about, maybe even in terms of guilt and pleasure. I wanted to know if there was more science behind it than I was aware of.
Flipping through the pages, you can indeed see references to politics and feminism. There's also mention of economic theory, federalism, nuclear bombs, colonialism, mental illness, and cake in pop culture. There's so much stuff in there.
It was really fun. I remember in Basel, the design university I was at, it had a top floor library, which overlooked all the hills and mountains, and it was beautiful. It was just pure glass, and you sat there and looked out, and it was really one of the most beautiful kind of isolated experiences I've had related to my work. And I just pulled every book out of the shelf I could find, and they had a wonderful kind of online library as well that I could really dig into, and all the different PDFs I was kind of leafing through. Read lots about the traditions of wedding cakes, cutting the cake, where the traditions came from, what was used, leaving the top tier for the christening, the symbolism of cutting a cake together. And you, of course, inevitably also got into the politics of sugar.
The politics of sugar?
Yes. I mean, this is extracted, for a lack of a better word, of course, from colonial areas and then imported to Europe and used as kind of the most expensive material. And it was really a material of wealth and showing off with it as much as you could. And hence these wedding cakes, especially kind of royal wedding cakes. I think it was Victoria and Albert that had a uniquely impressive cake. And I think pieces of that cake are still being sold on auction currently. You can still buy a piece of their wedding cake.
Wow.
And that chip preserves. I mean, it's fruitcake that lasts forever. Yeah, and it was, I'm not sure anymore about the precise history, but I believe that there were actually two cakes, and one that was shown to the public as kind of this demonstration of wealth. And then also pieces of it were given away very symbolically. And I think there was a different one that they actually had at their wedding. Yeah. But it was very much showcased. It became the part that the public could connect to this very royal exclusive event that they were not able to experience, as today we can watch these events on TV, for example, but back then that was not possible. So that was that one medium that really crossed the border.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I think that also really relates to the research, or even just to the levels of research you can do. Researching cake, you rarely find things about a generic everyday cake. You find things about cakes that stood out, cakes that had a story, cakes that were about something, birthday cakes, wedding cakes, ritualistic cakes. I also looked into this whole, I think we also briefly touched on it. It was this whole ritual about cutting cakes if you're from two different political sides or different countries, and you come together and everyone holds the knife and you're like 10 people holding the knife and cutting the cake together. It was never about the cake, and it was really hard to find any research about this, but it was about everything that happened around that moment. I have so much research about guilt and consumption. That really was kind of the largest amount of research I found relating to cake.
Yeah.
Which I think also leads into this book about the women's cookbooks.
We'd been talking about how certain sources of information are considered historical and some are not. And women's cookbooks, despite them being used for not just recipes but as journals, they can be very valuable sources of historical and cultural information, but they are often ignored.
These things are maybe just not recorded. Maybe there is much more depth in it than we realize, but these things have not really been accepted as research or kind of shown and distributed in the same way as kind of scientific research has been, or political history research in some sorts. We give different values to it and also different quality of distribution and sharing of knowledge. I researched cake in a library. I didn't go to the grandmothers of Switzerland and ask them. I looked through the books and records.
Why?
Because that was the point of language of power. And how can I have a conversation again using the medium I know? So maybe graduating from using cake to get into design school to using cake to begin or be part of a political discussion. You need to know the right words. So for design, I needed to know that I was talking about form and function and product and consumer and whatever. This is a language that is quite common to you and me. But when you want to be part of a political discussion or I'd really love to work with a researcher, with a scientist on kind of more questions behind cake in what I've researched, be it guilt, be it the effect of sugar on the body. I don't know. But for me to do that, I have to learn the right phrases and terms to be able to have these discussions, to be taken seriously in that way. To then perhaps take what I learned from that conversation back into the design world, or what I understand design in that moment being is more finding ways of communicating this with a larger audience or more people or whoever. So this cake exploration, or this research and this very literary and library research that I did, was really just a basis for me to have the right kind of conversations with the right kind of people to get me more information, to bring me to different places, to open my eyes to different ways of seeing what I'm working with. So, yeah, I wrote this book a few years ago, actually. But it's not really, it doesn't feel like mine yet. So I really want to get there again to actually preparing for the conversation. I kind of look back through it and I'm really excited by it, but it's so many pieces of different people's stories. So it's a book kind of filled with quotes or anecdotes about happenings relating to cake, or where cake is used as a symbolism for something. And actually reading the Marshall McLuhan Medium as a Massage, I kind of started to see how I could maybe create something of my own by using a lot of other people's or kind of existing material, which is kind of my golden mountain. But yeah, definitely not there yet. So it's still growing and moving inside of me. But I think every conversation like ours would definitely bring me a step up there somehow to move closer to doing that one day.
If the medium is the message, and it doesn't matter what we say on TV, why are we all here tonight? And why am I asking this question?
I didn't say it didn't matter what you asked on TV. I said that the effect of TV, the message of TV, is quite independent of the program. That is, there is a huge technology involved in TV which surrounds you physically. And the effect of that huge service environment on you personally is vast. The effect of the program is incidental.
So, why should we care about all this? When McLuhan was saying this in the 60s and the 70s, not many people took him seriously. Can't you tell by the way that question was asked? His books were misunderstood, his theories were misrepresented, his views dismissed. He went on talk shows and became famous on television, yes, but he couldn't get a lot of academics to take him seriously. He became a sort of self-parody. But media researchers now are looking back at what he said and are seeing that he was right in so many ways. He described how people would behave in the digital age, how media would change us, how products would start becoming services, and how the world would become a global village. In a way, he predicted the internet. Through his obsession with media and his theory of transformation, he transformed how we study media today. And designers should care just as much about their media, because most often, designers are designing the medium, not the message. When you're making an app for a startup, or you're designing a poster for an exhibition, or even when you're writing the slogan for a brand, the message isn't from the designer. Like, take Nike's slogan, "Just do it." Some copywriter probably came up with the slogan after they sat in some meeting with the heads of Nike and were told what emotions it should convey, you know, how their customers should feel when they hear the slogan. The copywriter comes up with those three words, "Just do it." But those words are just the packaging of the message. The words are just the medium, and it's often that way with all other forms of design. You understand the client's message and design the medium of its communication. And Orlando is one of those designers who cares deeply about her medium. For her, cake is not the end product, it's the starting point. She understands the connotations of cake, the metaphors and the stories associated with it. And through that, she becomes a better communicator. That's why she's such a great example for all designers. Whether you design apps or graphics, products or services, or podcasts or cakes, we should all be paying attention to the medium we're designing in and designing for. And speaking of cake, this is going to sound silly, but I learned how to divide a piece of cake with another person only a year ago.
So when you're splitting a cake, there's always that who gets the bigger one thing going on. And so my friend said the most obvious thing. He said, I mean, it seems obvious now, but he said, okay, you cut the cake and I'll pick which piece I want. And I was blown away because that made so much sense. I was like, how did I not think of that?
I love that. You brought something perfect up, and I can actually say there's theory behind what you're telling me.
I see.
So for that, I'll read you another bit of my little smart booklet.
Yes.
So this is from Stephen J. Brams and Alan D. Taylor. Stephen J. Brams is an American game theorist and political scientist, and Alan D. Taylor is a mathematician. And together they wrote a book in 1996 called Fair Division, From Cake Cutting to Dispute Resolution. And this, again, is a reason why I love cake. This is mad. So this is just a really short excerpt from their book. As a first step towards specifying criteria for determining satisfaction, consider the well-known procedure for dividing a cake between two people, whom we will call Bob and Carol. Bob cuts the cake and Carol chooses one of the two pieces. We assume that the cake is divisible, so it can be cut at any point without destroying its value. Yet it need not be homogeneous or the same throughout. Rather, we suppose it be heterogeneous, wherein the flavors are mixed together but not stirred well. Thus, rather than thinking of a layer cake in which the flavors are completely separate, or a cake in which the flavors have been completely mixed and have the same consistency throughout, imagine a cake wherein there are uneven swirls of, say, chocolate and vanilla. Even though a piece may be 3/8 chocolate and 5/8 vanilla, there is no way to separate the chocolate from the vanilla by cutting the cake. Switching the imaginary and introducing preferences, suppose Carol likes the left side of a cake because it is thicker with frosting than the right side. Suppose Bob, who is on a diet, has the opposite preference but still would like the cherry in the middle. And both players may like nuts, but they are scattered with concentrations on both the left and the right sides, but not many in the middle. Patently, these preferences for the different toppings make this cake not only heterogeneous, but also difficult for the players to divide in a way that will satisfy both.
Mm.
I read this earlier again, and I haven't looked at it in 3 years, I think. And this is so beautiful. Like, how can a political scientist and a mathematician come together and explain the theory of fair division through cake so anybody gets it? And you started out by saying this exact thing, like you divide it and the person who didn't divide it gets to pick. But then that they layered with all these beautiful and very precise examples of nuts and chocolate, and you can see it. You can see it happening. And you're like, yeah, you cut it, but I really like the vanilla. And that's okay, because you need to express these things, because someone else might prefer the chocolate, but he assumes because he prefers it that you would prefer it too. And I think this beautiful complexity in such a simple object is really what fascinates me about the medium.
Music for this episode is by Text Me Records, Anna Domini Beats, Wayne Jones, and Patrick Patricios. As always, thank you so much for listening to the third episode of Cognitive Snap. Subscribe to the podcast, rate it on Apple Podcasts, and share it with your friends and enemies. And take care. Until next time.